I think the idea of being a professional actor wasn't even in my consciousness. I think in like 2022, 2023, my mental health was so bad. I was so insecure, so anxious, to the point where it was debilitating. I think when I was younger, I had such high expectations put upon me, like of what I could achieve. Very smart. For a young age, and then my development just stagnated and everyone caught up. But they expected me to continue on that trajectory. My family from a young age have always told me, you're so special. You're so special. You're going to go do great things. I haven't achieved what they wanted for me. I haven't met their standards. I haven't met their expectations, and I never will. So that's why I constantly feel like a failure.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of A Millennial Mind. Today, I am so excited to introduce you all to Charithra, who was the diamond of Bridgerton, and she really opens up in this conversation about her journey, her acting career, and her mental health. Before we begin this podcast, I just want to ask you all for one really big favor, and that is to press the follow, like, and subscribe button wherever you're watching or listening to this podcast. I know so many of you are not doing it, and it just takes 2 seconds, and it would mean the absolute world to me. So if you can, I'd be so grateful if you could do that before we get into this episode. Charithra.
Hi.
Welcome to Millennial Mind.
Thank you.
The Diamond of Bridgerton.
Oh my goodness.
For people who don't know who you are, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am an actor. I am of South Asian descent. I think my path into acting has been a bit unconventional. I think, I don't know what else to
say.
It's
such a hard question, isn't it?
When I tell people, even am I?
When people say that to me, I'm like, don't know. But I love always asking that question.
Yeah. It's so interesting. And I think really cultural how people answer that question, actually, because I find that like Brits and Americans, we often start with like our job. Did you see how I went, I'm an actor, as the first thing to the question, who are you? It's like such a capitalist mindset of like, we must, you know, contribute to the economy. Whereas I feel like in other countries, they might start with their hobbies. They might say, I love to cook, or I'm a mother, or I'm a sister. It's very interesting. But for me, like, obviously acting is more than my job. It's my number one love, so...
It's so funny you said that. I was going to bring that point up in this podcast, which is like so crazy. I went to a dinner and someone said that they think they went to Norway. And they said that...
They think they went to Norway.
I don't know if it was Norway. It was like, I think they went to Norway.
Like, do they know?
I can't remember where they went. I think it was Norway. And he said the exact same thing. He was like, when people ask you what you do in the UK and in the US, people will say, well, they say their job. Mm. And he was like, there they say, I'm a swimmer.
Yeah.
I'm a gardener.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I love to run. I'm a runner.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting here. If I said I'm a runner, people would be like, yeah, so what do you get paid for?
Yeah.
And people still say that to me with a podcast. They're like, okay, so you have a podcast, but like...
How do you get paid?
How do you get paid? First question people constantly ask me. And it's so interesting because it's so linked to that capitalist mindset. I'm so happy you said that. It's so, so interesting. You said your career into acting was a bit unconventional.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, I was a child actor, but then, like, obviously the traditional Indian family, very academic, mm-hmm. academic focused. And, they just, like, I think the idea of being a professional actor wasn't even in my consciousness for me to want it and for it to be rejected. So then I went to uni and I got, like, a corporate job. And it was only in COVID that I, like, really thought about life and I decided to give it a go. And
what did you study?
Philosophy, politics and economics.
PPE, where did you study?
Oxford.
Stop it.
Yeah.
That's like crumb de la crumb degree, by the way. Because when I was doing law, everyone would be like, I'm doing PPE. And I was like, damn it, why didn't I do that bloody subject? It's like, it's I actually think it's like such an amazing degree because I love philosophy.
Yeah.
But wow, that's unbelievable. So when you said you were a child actor, how did you kind of get into that? Did your parents put you forward or?
No, it's because I loved performing so much. They put me in something called Stagecoach.
Okay.
Which was like a weekend drama school. It's 3 hours. Either Friday, Saturday or Sunday. And yeah, like through Stagecoach, you get opportunities and, you know, I was working for a bit. Nothing super serious, nothing ever prominent, but I loved it. It's one of those things where like, when did you, people ask, when did you know you wanted to be this? Or when did you know you enjoyed this? But for me, literally since I was a baby, like, I've just been performing. It's what I want to do. Like, it's crazy. Like, I will, you know, be on set or doing whatever, and I'll come home and I'll want to make silly videos, or I want to, like, sew, knit, like, all of this kind of stuff.
Amazing.
So I've always loved creating and specifically performing.
That's unbelievable. Oh my gosh, unreal. So yeah. I'm just thinking from an Indian parent, okay? Because, like, very interestingly, I always loved drama at school. My parents were like, yeah, well, you get to do 1 hour class and that's it. And that's why a stagecoach, I always wanted to go.
Yeah.
That's why I'm like, so like, oh, that's so amazing that you actually got to do that. But you did PPE at Oxford and then you graduate. Where did you get a corporate job?
BCG, Boston Consulting
Group.
Oh
my God, you're like a genius. This is like, this is mad. Okay, so you get a job at BCG. Yeah. Okay. Anything else you want to tell me? That's crazy.
Yeah.
How did you then kind of tell your parents, or kind of have the time also, because we're in consulting?
Yeah.
So how did you kind of have the time to go into acting or start even, you know, exploring that?
So I actually requested a sabbatical from, not sabbatical, but basically BCG offer like a year out.
Okay.
And I just asked for an extension on that year out, and I told my parents, like, you know, give me a year. If I don't, like, give me a year to get it out of my system, or like, to try to make this happen. And if it doesn't, I can always go back.
And how old were you?
At the time, 22.
So you'd only been working there for maybe like 2 years?
No, oh my God. I'd like done my internship there. I had got my job and then I took the year out. Sorry, I wasn't very clear. I graduated. So I went into my final year with the job offer. I graduated and then they offered a year out.
Oh, I see.
And so in that year out, yeah.
That makes so much sense. Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, because a sabbatical is like when you've been there for years, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So you were just like, can I defer my entry almost?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. And why did you at that point wanted to go into acting?
It felt like the last opportunity that I like could really give it a go, which is not even true. It's not.
No.
You can get into it at any time, but you know, I just thought I owe it to myself to try it. And it felt really zero risk, right? Because I was like, well, give it a go for a year, see how it goes. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out.
And your parents were okay?
Yeah, well, they couldn't really say anything because I wasn't sacrificing anything. If after the year, I could go back to BCG.
I think it's also, we're in a bit of a different situation here, if I'm honest, because like you've got this unbelievable degree and then an unbelievable job offer. My parents were probably just like, you're never going to get a job, so just take the first one you get, all right?
Really? Do they say that?
Well, no. The difference is I wasn't as academic as you. And so I think that it's a very, I think, immigrant mindset as well. It's like you should be grateful, and whilst you have something, you should never let it go. So my parents were always very much like, I was very ingrained as a child to believe that I should always take what I could get.
I think culturally we're very risk averse.
Very. And so for me, it was like, you're going to find a job and now that you've got a job, you should take it. And if you want to then explore other things, you can always do it after.
That's what my mum would say. She would be like, why don't you just let it be a hobby? Join a community theatre group. And I'm like, working 70 hours a week.
Because BCG is insane. So that's why I was like, how did you have the time?
It's mad.
Okay, so talk me through that. What did you do? Because also, I actually want to touch upon something. Have you always had a lot of confidence?
I think that every single person who's ever met me would say, yes, she's very confident. And I always have been. I've always been very loud, extroverted, all of that. I think I'm also very insecure. I would say I've always been very confident.
I think all of us are really insecure. And I think that it's so funny because people would say that about me. You know, you're so confident and you're so chatty. But I'm always like in certain areas of my life, right? It's not like at every point of my life I feel very confident. But what made you at that moment believe that, you know, I can do this? Because that's a big, it is, whilst it's like not a big risk, it is also a big risk, right? Because you never know.
Well, I don't think that I ever thought that I could do this. But I think I thought I should give it a go.
And that, like, intuition.
Yeah, I don't think it was ever like, oh, I'm talented enough, I'm a star, I'm like, I don't think I ever thought any of that. But I just think I thought I owe it to myself to give this a go. And truthfully, you know, my parents immigrated to find new opportunities, and like they're in a survival mentality. They're like, just survive.
Yeah.
But I kind of think, like, well, then what's the point of all this sacrifice? Surely someone has to, like, enjoy the fruits of the labor, right? In a way, I thought going into acting and actually choosing to thrive as opposed to survive, choosing, like, a passion over survival is a way of honoring all of their hard work and sacrifice. Otherwise, what's the point? I'm going to put that same pressure on my kid. They're going to put it on their kid. And then, like, who's thriving? Everyone's just getting by. And, like, that's a miserable existence. So for me, although my parents probably don't see it that way, I really think it's honouring my parents.
Oh, my God, that's so beautiful, by the way. That's such a lovely way to look at it as well. So talk to me about that kind of year. So you've postponed your job offer. Where do you start?
Good question. Well, COVID happened. So I think I joined, like, various... I Googled, I did a lot of research, I asked people. I think I've always been good... I've always been a hard worker, or I'd say a smart worker, and I've always been a hustler. Like, I'll work. So I researched, I joined, like, various websites and Facebook groups where you can sign up to do short films so I could get, like, a reel together. And then COVID happened, and obviously everything shut down. And I literally cold emailed various agencies.
No way.
So a lot of luck. Like, it was right time, right place, people. I also think, like, if I'm being really honest, Black Lives Matter happened over the summer of 2020, right? And I think that a lot of companies, as we saw, reevaluated, like, their employee structure, mm-hmm. et cetera, and realized they need more diversity. And I think that also came into the film industry, right? A lot of agencies looked at their books of clients, actors that they represent, and they went, oh, God, like, there aren't that many people of color. So I think, you know, I happen to be a beneficiary of this social movement that, like, has obviously done a lot of good for a lot of people.
That's amazing.
I do think that because I started, like, cold emailing agents in, like, June, July of 2020. Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
And then when did you kind of get a break? Because when did you kind of defer your offer from?
From September 2019 to September 2020. But then, because COVID happened, they, like, offered, they were like, if you want to take an extra 6 months off, take an extra 6 months off. And I was like, yeah, okay.
Okay, so did you hear anything in that period? Anything from these roles?
So I signed up, so I'd been signed to an agent.
Okay.
But I was auditioning and, you know, I was having fun auditioning. That's what's really interesting. When I had nothing to lose or, like, no credits to my name, I put no pressure on any audition, no pressure on myself. And it's like now that I do have credits to my name and I feel so much more pressure for every audition I do. Yeah. But yeah, by September 2020, I hadn't booked anything. But I gave myself a deadline of, like, I need to book something by the end of the year. So in 3 months. And literally, I remember, like, the 17th of December, I got offered a series regular on my first, like, professional TV credit, which was Alex Rider.
No way.
Literally, like, I was spending Christmas with my dad, maybe even later than 17th, actually.
Oh, my gosh, that's unbelievable.
That actually felt like a real it's meant to be moment. It really did.
And can I ask, were you living with one of your parents?
Yeah.
Okay, so that was also kind of, like, comforting.
Yeah, I also think, like, I was working other jobs, obviously.
Okay.
The year that I was trying to become an actor, I had other jobs to make money. I was a research analyst at a NGO. Wow. And I was doing lots of, like, although this was volunteering, obviously, lots of charity work to help people during COVID and stuff like that. But yeah, it felt like a real meant to be moment.
That's unbelievable. And then when did you get the call for Bridgerton?
So I auditioned for Bridgerton end of 2020. And then I got asked to audition for another role, maybe like March 2021, February 2021. But I was contractually obliged to another TV show. So I was like, oh, I don't know. Okay. And then, it took, like, a month of manoeuvring to make it work with both shows.
Wow.
And that also felt really meant to be because it, like, at any point, either of the TV shows could have been like, this is too much work during a pandemic. Like, no, we'll just get someone else. And the fact that both productions like worked so hard in the middle of a pandemic to make the schedules work, make it happen. I'm so grateful.
That is crazy. And did your life kind of like turn overnight?
No.
Or no?
I don't think so.
Because Alex Rider was a very big show in itself.
Yeah, I don't think so, no. I don't think so. I can see from the outside why it might feel that way, but I think everything's felt so iterative. Like every exciting thing happens and then another bigger exciting thing happens. So it slowly builds up.
Yeah, I think people do look at it and they kind of see it as like an overnight thing, right? But you've been like doing it and seeing it every single day. So it kind of obviously feels different. Mm. How did you cope with all of that though? Because you kind of just had an intense 3 years, or was it 4 years at Oxford?
Three.
3 years at Oxford, then you had like a little bit of a slower year because of COVID, obviously. And then you were like on set with one show and now you're managing two shows. How was that for you to kind of cope with?
I think I loved it at the time because it was still like we were kind of semi-lockdown. So I didn't really have much else to do. And I love my job. If I could, like, it's so interesting. I was at the pub with a friend and he was talking about like why we should move to a 4-day work week. And in theory, I was like, yeah, that would be like such a better quality of life for people. But I wouldn't want that because I like my job. I love acting and I would want to do it every day. I do it in my free time. Like I make silly TikTok videos. Most of the world will never see. Like, I want to do it all the time.
That's so amazing. And so at what point did you kind of realise, okay, I'm not going back to BCG?
I still don't know if I'm there yet. Sometimes I think...
No way!
Yeah, no. I completely think I'm, like, such a flop. I, like, constantly think I'm a failure. So I'm like, oh, God, do you think BCG will take me?
No way. Okay, yeah. Let's talk about that, because I think that a lot of people that are watching this, and I told a few people I was doing a podcast with you, they were like, oh, my God, no way. Aww. I can't believe you're going to see her tomorrow. And I was like, I've actually seen her before, guys. I just wanted to tell you. It's really interesting, because I... Recently, whenever I speak to people who are very successful, they never often see that they're successful from their own eyes. And it's not like they don't appreciate it or that they don't believe that they've done all these amazing things. It's still the fact that they have massive levels of imposter syndrome.
I think it's... firstly, like, you saying very successful, like, does not register to me. I'm like, no, I'm not. Like, it just does not. I'm really not pretending. I cannot tell you how much that sentiment does not register in my head. I think I'm a failure. It's not imposter syndrome. It's more just I haven't achieved what I want to achieve.
So why does that mean you're a failure?
Because I don't know. I guess you're right. Like, that is an interesting way to reframe it. But, you know, I think I just feel like I haven't done what I've set out to do and I haven't worked enough and I haven't booked enough roles and I haven't done X, Y, Z things that was I expected of myself or other people expected of me. But, yeah, no, I like it just does not register.
How old are you?
27.
So you're 27. You've been the star of a Netflix show. You are now going to do a one-woman play and you are like a brand ambassador for some of the most incredible brands. And I was at the Cartier party with you.
Oh, yeah.
And out of all of those people at the Cartier party, they chose you to do that. So what would you define as success?
And this is like the life journey. You know, my aunt said to me, she was like, I believe you'll have everything in life but contentment. And that's what she worries about. She's like, you know, with, you know, an Indian family is like all the cousins are seen as like everyone's children.
Yeah.
She's like, I worry about other, you know, other kids and their careers and socializing and all this. She says, I just want you to be happy.
Yeah.
She's like, that's what I worry for you. I worry that you won't be happy. And what she means by happiness, I'm a very happy person.
Yeah.
What she means by that is like feeling fulfilled.
Yes.
Being satisfied, satiated. And I think the goalpost will always shift. Like, I remember once I booked my first job. Booking the first job, the happiness was there for a while. But then I booked Bridgerton, and I think I was happy for, like, 20 seconds. And then I was like, right, what's next?
I do think that's normal for people who are very ambitious. And, you know, you've been very ambitious all your life.
Mm.
I do think
it's toxic, though. It's not good.
It is.
And I think that we, like... kind of, it's same with hustle, you know, like overworking and not sleeping. I think we've like romanticized it as, oh, successful people don't sleep.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
And like don't work all this time and like they don't see their friends and family. And,
yeah, so they're so cool because they're so busy all the time. Yeah.
And it's like similarly, the idea of always wanting more and not being content is seen as like really cool or like a sign of a successful person. But it depends on what you measure as success, right?
100%.
Like to me, a successful person is someone with like someone that is genuinely so fulfilled, purposeful, lives a very intentional life.
But I don't think that you have to think that you're not there yet because you want more. I think we've confused success and contentment as like they're mutually exclusive.
Mm.
I'm also like that. And I feel like with every person I get on the podcast or anything that I do, I'm just like, but what's next? I need to do something revolutionary and do it more. And an exercise that I did last year or like the year before, I can't remember, because I had like manifested so many things and they had happened, I then felt like I wasn't enjoying them because anything that happened, I was like, okay, but I want this now and I want this now. And one of the exercises I did last year is I wrote out my whole year. And I said, this is going to happen for you, this is going to happen for you, this is going to happen for you, this is going to happen for you. And I said, it's only 1 year of your life, Shivani. And then when I started seeing things happen, I was enjoying them. Because I, like you, was in a situation where like something was happening to me and I was happy, but I wanted to focus on the next goal and the next goal and the next goal. And I do think it that does come from this like dog-eat-dog culture and like rat race that we're all in. And I remember leaving my corporate job to do this and I was like, I've just left one rat race to go to another. And I feel like I'm just not enjoying it.
Mm.
And I've just realized that I'm still very young. If I got, okay, if you got everything you wanted to, like all of your dreams, everything that would make you successful, which you already are, by the way, but everything that would make you successful right now at this moment, if someone could click a finger and you could get it, you still wouldn't be happy.
And that is exactly it. It's like, what is the end goal? It's defining the end goal. And it's obviously going to be like quite abstract and, you know, generic maybe, but that is the journey that I'm on right now. It's like, what does the end look like? And I always think about, I think it's Cool Runnings, where the coach is like, if you're not happy with one gold medal, you're not going to be happy with four.
Yeah.
And so it's that kind of thing. It's pushing yourself. That, and it also like doing it for the right reasons, right? But sometimes you do get carried away. I want to be the best actor I can be and push myself creatively and like my craft. But it's so easy to get sucked into seeing like how your success is measured to other people.
So true.
And so that's the journey. It's like, I want to be the best actor I can be and I'll never reach it, but I want to find joy in just improving and that being the end goal, always improving. But yeah, it's really hard.
I think it's really difficult. First of all, I just want to say, like, you are phenomenal. And I also want to, like, remind you, if you don't know, like, you're very early. Like, you're so young. Like, you've got your whole life.
But it feels like in Hollywood, it feels like, you know, everybody has achieved so much by my age. And
what about Meryl Streep?
But I feel like I started late. Do you know what I mean? Like, the girls are starting at, like, 15, 16 now. They're winning Oscars by, like, 24. And I feel, in my industry, I feel like a lost little lamb. But that is interesting because I felt that way at Oxford, right? Where I was like, by the way, I was like, I got a first, like I was very successful at Oxford too, but the point
is,
but the point is, there were people at Oxford that were geniuses, you know, like.
Like you.
No. I work hard, but I'm not a genius, I'm really not. But there were people that were just like these crazy minds and like inspiring minds. Like you don't even know how their brain works. It's so crazy. And I used to think, I'm so dumb. Like you're surrounded by people that are so catastrophic and represent like so not the norm. And you compare yourself to those people and you go, I'm so dumb. I'm so stupid. I'm an idiot.
It's so true.
I think a lot of people in like these elite institutions do that. If they're at the bottom of the elite institution, you're still at the top in general. It's the same in like, I guess now, maybe the professional circles I'm in.
It's
I feel
true.
Like I'm at the bottom of the top.
I totally do, you know what I mean? Relate.
And so I'm looking up and I'm going, I'm failing. I'm so bad. Like, I'm terrible. I'm not booking the roles I want to book. But, like, that's because I only see the people in front of me. I'm not looking at the people behind me.
It's so true.
And that's what I'd say. I'm at the bottom of the top. I'm at the very bottom of the top.
Are you feeling this way because you recently went to something?
Well, no. I think I always feel this way.
Really?
Yeah, and it's like, even with auditions, right? It's like, now I'm in a place where I'm going for really cool, exciting roles with amazing directors, amazing teams. Yeah. And so it's a very different, like, pond.
Yes.
I'm in a very different pond. And so I have to remind myself, like, it's very, very easy to look at that pond and go, oh, I'm like the worst in it, instead of, oh, but I'm like in the most elite pond in the ocean.
But remember, you jumped into the first pond when you didn't know what you were doing the first time. And you made
it
through.
I was relaxed.
Yeah.
It's so funny, like, when I had no money and no success, I was so much more chill.
Yeah.
Than I am now.
It's so, that pressure is, I relate to you so much because I recently went to a dinner and it was like Jay Shetty, Elizabeth Day, Joe Wicks, Dr. Rangan, Elizabeth Hills, wow. Roxy Nafuzi, and all these people. And I sat there and after the dinner, I was like, I feel like a complete failure. Like, why was I invited? Why was I there? These guys are getting like millions of downloads per episode. Yeah. And I'm like, oh my, I'm at the bottom. And I remember walking away from that and actually feeling really shit. And I should have walked away from it because everyone was like, oh my God, you were at this dinner and you deserved a seat at the table. And like, you really deserved to be there. And I was like, yeah. No, I didn't.
And like, that's why you need to be surrounded by friends, because my friends remind me of that.
Yes. And also, but my reflection away from that was, I've been in a room where I've been too comfortable for too long. And now I'm in a room where these guys are pushing me.
That's so true.
And I was like, I've got to look at it as if, you know, Jay, who invited me, if he believes I should be there, then why don't I?
Mm.
And I almost turned that on its head. I was really upset for like a few days. And I was like, I didn't say the right thing. And like, oh my God, I messed my speech up and my reflection was really bad. And I think so many of us beat ourselves up when we feel like we're not good enough. But all of us have to remember that we have our own path. And when you feel you're falling behind, you don't know when it's going to be your time to excel. You don't know when the graph is going to literally go like that.
But it also might not, right? And I think there's like also a level where I think I also, my dream would be able to get to a place where if, like, the reality is, yes, we have all these goals and I'm a very ambitious person, but ultimately, like, I want to feel grateful for, like, having shelter, having food, being safe. Like, if I don't achieve my goals, I am still living, like, an amazing life.
100%.
And so it's also remembering that, so.
Did you struggle at all with your mental health while managing all of these different things?
Oh my God, yeah, like, I think in like 2022, 2023, my mental health was so bad. I was so, like, so insecure, so anxious, and like, not to the point where it was clinical, but to the point where it was debilitating. And, I was lucky enough to be able to afford therapy, and now I like have a lot of coping mechanisms. I also think that I've matured and I'm in a much better place. But yes, for sure.
Why did you have so much anxiety?
I think like because it was a life change, right? Having this pressure on you, these expectations. But yeah, I think it was just the life change aspect.
I think when you're in the limelight, obviously Bridgerton was like one of the most watched shows on Netflix. I know what you mean in the sense of like, well, how am I going to top it? Or how am I going to keep up with it? And what am I? And everyone's probably talking about, what are you going to do next? And that can be really confusing because you're like, I don't really know right now. I just need like a minute to like process what's going on. How did you cope with that?
It's not fun. And you can't help but compare yourself to your co-stars, your colleagues, like what you think you should be doing in comparison. But also, like, everyone's journey is so unique. You can't make those comparisons. I'm also a brown woman. Like, it's not right. It's so silly of me to compare myself to my white peers. But comparison truly is the thief of joy. We're all on our own journeys. And, like, also, Bridgerton was my second job.
Yeah.
Right? And my friends always remind me of that. Like, they're like, you're so fresh. Like, need to grow. You need to learn. You need to just grow as an actor, as a person. And I'm now at a stage where if Bridgerton is the biggest thing I ever do, it's an amazing thing to have ever done. And, like, I just want to continue being challenged and creatively fulfilled. I'm just really trying to change my metrics of success to be internal.
I think exactly what your friends just said, like, you are so new. Mm. And I think a lot of the time when you do something that's so phenomenal, you're like, how you just said, you don't think you're successful, right? Because you haven't done all the things that you wanted to do. But what you achieved in such a short period of time is such a testament to how much of an amazing actor you are. And so I know this is annoying that I'm going to be like, who knows what you're going to do? Because, like, don't put the pressure on me in case I do. But my point is that you got that because of your talent. Right?
You did. Right.
No, you did.
I don't know. It's so hard to believe that. I think that is my biggest insecurity. It depends on what crowd I'm in, I guess. Like, when I'm with certain crowds, I feel insecure about my intellect.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Certain crowds, like, everyone in the room has PhDs. And and most of my family have done more than just a BA. And I've just got my BA. And I'm like, oh, I'm so dumb. I feel so insecure. But then I'm in this industry and I'm like, everyone in this room thinks I'm a terrible actor. Like, I genuinely walk in, yeah.
Where do you think that comes from?
She's such a, like, it's luck. I always presume people think it's luck.
I think the same. I'm always like, everyone does think everything is luck. But where has that come from for you?
I guess, I don't know.
When was the first time, I did this actually exercise in therapy, when was the first time that you felt that I'm not good enough?
I think, oh my goodness. I think it wasn't that, okay, this is where it came from, I think. I think when I was younger, I had such high expectations upon me.
Yeah.
Like, of what I could achieve. And I have been told by family that I haven't met those expectations. And it won't be like, oh, you failed. Like, literally every birthday, and most times I call my grandparents, they'll say, when you were young, you were so capable, you were so smart, you were so bright. What happened to that little girl? Every birthday.
Why do they think that? Because you didn't go into consulting?
No. They just think that, like, I was very smart for a young age, and then my development just stagnated and everyone caught up. But they expected me to continue on that trajectory, which was never my trajectory, it was never my journey. But, like, I constantly get fed back that I'm not meeting expectations.
Wow.
Yeah.
A lot of what we feel is like, but goes back to a root. And
yeah.
Sorry, that's such a deep question. But
no.
That is when I think when someone asked me that question, I was like, wow, everything does trace back to your childhood.
But you know, when my therapist asked me, he was like, what's your biggest fear? Like, really think about it. Like, what's the thing that you do all your life? Because, you know, I asked him, like, why am I so obsessed with being the center of attention? Why am I so obsessed? Which I'm not even, right? Like, I'm saying these things. I'm like, why am I so obsessed with needing to be the smartest person in the room? Why am I so obsessed with being needing to be, like, the one that is the most attractive person, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, the superlative of all sorts. And he was like, well, what are you most afraid of? And I really thought about it and I said, I'm most afraid of mediocrity. I'm most afraid of being forgettable, the average, the norm. Mediocrity and not being special is like my biggest fear. And I don't know what that says. Is that narcissism? I don't know. But like, that is my biggest fear because my family from a young age have always told me, you're so special. You're so special. You're so special. you're going to go do great things. And I haven't achieved what they wanted for me. I haven't met their standards. I haven't met their expectations, and I never will. So that's why I constantly feel like a failure.
Wow. Well, even now, your family will say that.
Yeah.
It's just fascinating to me.
And they're not saying it like, you're a failure.
Yeah.
It will literally be like, it will always be kind of in a reverse way of, we always thought you were going to do that. Like when the joke about Rishi Sunak becoming prime minister, literally like the joke, it genuinely happened. And my family texted me being like, we always thought that was your path. You were going to be the first one.
No.
And it's a joke because it's something that like you'd see in a skit of like, goodness gracious me or something. It genuinely happened.
Does that still really affect you?
Yeah, it definitely does. It definitely frustrating. I think part of it is like I've heard it so much now, but it is definitely where I constantly feel like a failure. Why am I so scared? And my therapist asked me, what about if you were really happy? What if you were really loved? You had a wonderful husband, family, friends, siblings, beautiful children. You know, that's what you want. And like you lived like a normal life. A normal life. Would you be happy? And I thought, no. I like wouldn't. And I feel really robbed of that happiness, actually, from my family. I really feel robbed of it.
Have you talked to your family about this?
Yeah, but I think it's also a cultural aspect.
Yes.
And it's really hard because it's out of love, right? Because you try to talk to, you know, your family about it and they're like, but we just think you're special.
Yeah.
Like it's from a place of love. And so it's one of those situations where they're like, but we don't get it. They really believe it. They really believe that I'm capable of things that I'm not capable of and that I'm super duper special when I'm not. And I feel resentful because I really feel robbed of happiness and fulfillment. I don't think I'll ever achieve it. Well, I shouldn't say that. That's a negative thing to say. I'm working on it and I hope I get there. But yeah.
It's so interesting to hear your perspective because I feel like I had the opposite. No one ever told me I was special.
Really?
And so I never believed I could do anything. And I actually always feel resentful of like, I wish you really like didn't always like put me down for being talkative and for being so inquisitive and for always being so curious. And you just said to me, I should just do the bare minimum. And I didn't push myself for years because I was always told I shouldn't.
Mm.
But it's so interesting how that dynamic is like so polar opposite. And yet two people feel very similar.
Yeah. I also think that like, and I don't think this is true. I don't even think this is true. But I always felt more loved when I was successful. I always felt more loved when I stood out. I always felt more loved when I was impressive.
Yeah.
I always felt like love and affection was qualified. And so then you think that like if I don't do well and if I don't keep excelling and growing and improving, I won't be loved. Like if you're convinced that love is conditional on success, you crave success.
Or you push away from that person.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that's why. And I don't know. I think when it's so deeply ingrained and you've had it all your life, I don't know how you overcome that. I mean, with a lot of work, which I have to put in, but yeah.
It's a really difficult journey, I think, in terms of like managing that relationship with yourself and managing a relationship with other people. And similar to you, I think, you know, for me, one of the biggest kind of mind-blowing moments in terms of relationships was when people would say, you shouldn't take my words literally. And I said, well, if you don't want me to attach meaning to your harsh words, how do you want me to attach meaning to your loving words?
Mm.
How can I do that? I either attach no meaning at all, or I believe the horrible things you say, and then I have to try and believe the nice things you say.
Mm.
But you can't expect me to believe the nice things you say and just ignore the horrible things you say.
Agreed.
And it's similar in your situation. Like, you can't expect me to just believe that you're proud of me, but then love me conditionally because of my success. And I don't know if it's an Indian thing.
I think it is. I think it definitely is an Indian thing. Not that every Indian is like
this.
No,
yeah, of course.
But I do. I think that... But what I say that, like, my family loves me unconditionally. Yes. Like, it's not conditional.
Yes.
It's not. It's in my head, I think, they would show it more when I was successful. They, like, will love me no matter what. And I know that. Like, I know that to be true. That is a statement of fact. But it's knowing something and believing something are very different things.
Yeah, completely.
You can know something and not believe it.
100%. Like, you know you're successful, but you don't believe it right now.
I genuinely don't know that or think that or believe that.
What do you think would change that?
Good question. I think it's that thing of you constantly, like, I'll constantly look up. And I don't know. I really, so silly. I really think that, like, having kids will mellow me out.
Really?
Because but I really worry, and I really hope I don't. I really worry that, like, the toxic mentality that I have, I'll pass on to them.
Oh my God, I think that all the time too. Like, when am I going to break the generational curse, right?
Yeah, I really worry about it. But I do think the moment I have kids, I'll be like, oh, this is the win.
Yeah.
This is the ultimate win. And just being a good mum is, like, that's the goal, right? Constantly trying to be the best mum. And I've always wanted to be a mum, actually. This is so interesting. People are so surprised. I'm such an ambitious person, but I've wanted nothing more than to be a mum.
Oh, for sure, me too.
Like, it's my number one goal in life.
I literally said that to my mum this morning. I was just like, I've just got engaged.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I just want to have a quick wedding because all I care about is having kids.
Yeah.
And people find it bizarre because they're like, but you, like, love your work. And yeah. I'm like, yeah, I do. I always believe I can do both. Mm. Don't know how I feel about that when I'm like, yeah, actually have to do it. But I think we put people in boxes and we say, you either choose your career or you choose your kids, and you're unable to do both. And this is kind of like related a little bit to what you do in terms of breaking that box, whether you did it in Bridgerton or you're doing it similarly in your play right now, right? Like, you're kind of being that voice of, like, you can define your own path.
Yeah, but I also think I would say, like, I think it's really toxic. The women can do it all thing. Like, women can't. Women absolutely can't. And I think it's really unfair on women. Like, from a feminist perspective, I think it's really anti-feminist to be like, women can do it all. Because men aren't expected to do it all.
100%. But I do think you can. I think you can have a career and have kids, though.
And you can love both.
Yeah, that's
absolutely
what I mean.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because I agree. I've talked about this as well. It's like, well, you're not going to be able to wake up at 5 and do the laundry and then change your kids and then go to your job and then come back and do everything else. And also this whole thing around, like, oh my God, men are so great because they look after their kids. I'm just like,
so what, then being a dad?
Yeah, it's a joke. But I also want to change the narrative of, like, I love my job, but I also really want to be a mother. And I think that, like, we see it as a choice. Like, you cannot have both. And if that means that one of them has to take a bit of a backseat, that's also fine.
But life is full of seasons, right?
Exactly.
It's like there are different periods of life where different things accelerate. And that's why I think I always say, like, my number one trait in a partner is he needs to be a feminist.
Yeah, we talked about that, I remember. Yeah.
Like, my number one trait, because I always think about, like, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her relationship with her husband. Her husband, while she was in law school, obviously was the more successful partner. But as soon as he saw his wife's potential, he took a backseat. His career took a backseat. Yeah. And in the same way that I would be willing to make those sacrifices for my future partner, they must be willing to make them for me. And, like, I see my aunt and uncle in America, and they're such an amazing role models for, like, a relationship where they both have amazing careers, two kids, and how you, like, genuinely support one another. Like, my aunt, she's an amazing mum. She's, like, you know, runs an NGO. And she's very open about the things that she can and can't do. And she doesn't allow herself to feel guilty.
Yeah.
She's like, I don't like to cook. So she just doesn't. She doesn't sit there wallowing in the fact she doesn't like to cook, because she's an amazing mum.
Yes.
She's, like, phenomenal at her job. She's a great friend. She's a great aunt. So, yeah, she's not trying to do it all because she knows she can't. So she does what she can with her strengths.
Yeah, 100%. I support that. And actually, it's so funny because people commented on my post and were like, I hope your partner can... God, it's so, I find it really weird to say, like, the word fiancé. Someone commented on my post and they were like, about my fiancé, they were like, I hope he can, like, handle you because you're so outspoken, and I hope he doesn't, like, you know, mellow you down. And I'm like, the reason I'm so confident is because of him.
Why would you be with a man that
I genuinely think my confidence level has completely shot up because for the first time I've been with someone who's not intimidated and not insecure if I speak my opinion. In fact, he's very much like, state it, talk about it, be confident in it. And I do think that having someone by your side that supports you is 100% the most important thing. But people get very, very stressed out when I use the word feminist. So what do you define as a feminist? God knows.
For me, it's very specific and I don't like a lot of... Because I have an academic background around this. I think that, like, feminism is about dismantling systems of oppression. And that's all systems of oppression. Whether that is to do with LGBTQ plus rights, race, sex, gender, etc. It's about dismantling systems of oppression. So I'm sorry, you can't be a racist feminist. You can't be a homophobic feminist, right? And so and within that obviously comes intersectionality. And for me, feminism is like inherently political. It's not about choices that we make. Our ability to make a choice is feminist. Doesn't mean every choice we make is a feminist one. I see many people making very anti-feminist choices in their lives, but your ability to choose is feminist. And I think that's a really important distinction that I feel like a lot of people have lost. But it's also about the group. It's about bettering oppressed groups. It's not about the individual. Feminism by its nature is a collective thing.
Because now people are saying, because of feminism, men are oppressed.
I don't care. I'm so over that. Like, it's giving such small dick energy. I guess I just don't exist in those spaces where people would say, I don't have
people.
Well,
it's my comment section, sorry. No. I just want to make that clear.
Of course. But like, how? Tell me how are you oppressed? It's like, if you so desperately want to be a victim, go, fine.
I think it's as a man, you just don't get it. Like, they don't understand the day-to-day.
Yeah.
And so for them, they're like, oh, well, you've got your rights. Now what do you want? And I think similar to what you said as well, you know, at the start of this conversation, you said, I can't compare myself to my white, you know, co-actors. Do you still feel that at the moment?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. I was at the BAFTAs yesterday. Not a single winner was brown. South Asian, I mean. Cast and crew. Not a single winner. So it's like really inspiring to be in those spaces. So inspiring because you think to yourself, like, I really want to be making projects that are of this quality. But I may be wrong, actually, like, don't quote me on this, but to my memory, yeah, not a single South Asian.
That's crazy. And so we've got a lot of work to do. And that's what I think people like are sometimes like, well, you know, we're seeing brown people in movies. So there we go. That's it. You know, there's always, I see this all the time as well. People are like, well, we're seeing loads of women talk about loads of issues now. So they've got their say. You've got your rights. What more do you want?
Well, I'm certainly not the person to have, like, invented this saying. It's been said many times. But I guess when, like, let's say you have 100 apples and someone has zero. Someone then having 30 apples might make you feel like they have 120 apples. When you only have 100. It's like when your status is at 100 and someone else is at a zero, them just being elevated to 30 and maybe you being brought down to 80 makes you feel like you're beneath the 30.
Oh, 100%.
Even when you're still way better. And that's what men are. I just like don't have time for it. I like can't entertain it because it's so stupid.
Yeah.
I'm so stupid I can't entertain it.
I love that
it's
analogy.
It's also not my job. Like, good men... Go and, like, help your own because I cannot handle that level of stupidity. I can't. I don't have patience for it.
But I also think good men educate themselves and they understand.
But then good men, and Daniel Sloss, the comedian, says it. You're not a good man because you don't rape women. That doesn't make you a good man. That makes you just, like, neutral. A good man will, like, dismantle a patriarchy and have conversations with men that have bad behavior. I'm not giving a man credit for the bare minimum. You're not a good man if you allow that behavior to go unchecked just because you don't do it yourself.
So this is the same if someone's like getting harassed in front of you. If you say nothing, then you're allowing them to do it.
Mm.
If you say something and you actually put that person in their place, that's only when you can actually say, like, okay, well, I've done something to help. But a lot of people are like, well, I didn't do that. I was watching him do it, but I wasn't doing that.
Yeah, I'm like, you're not a good person.
Yeah, I agree.
It's as simple as that for me. It's like, you're not, because you have power and you have authority as a man, right? Like, you have power and authority in a situation, and you chose it to allow bad to happen.
So true.
I hate saying, like, good person, bad person. You did a bad thing.
Yeah, you did a bad thing.
Like, people can't be condemned or praised like that, but it was a bad thing.
So much to talk about. I feel like this has turned into, like, a completely different direction. But I want to talk about your new play. Tell me about it.
It's called Instructions for a Teenage Armageddon. It's going to be at the Garrick Theatre starting 17th of March, written by Rosie Day. It's a one-woman show.
This is crazy.
I know.
So when you got casted for that, it's a one-woman show in the West End, and there's really not any South Asians that are main character one-woman show in the West End. Mm. How did you feel at that point?
I felt so honoured because, like, they picked me because they thought I could do it. I know I wasn't tokenised. You can just tell, right? Yeah. You just know. Because, yeah. Like, they saw a story that is a universal one. This is just about, like, teenage experience and a really... It's the most truthful and authentic teenage portrayal or writing I've ever seen in a play. I would say even, like, TV and film.
Wow.
Heartstopper is amazing, so that's pretty close. But, yeah. And so they were like, this is the right person to do this. It wasn't... because I'm brown, and it wasn't in spite of being brown. It was just they saw me as a person who would suit the character that I'm playing.
Did you feel differently about previous things before?
No.
Okay.
No. No, I don't think I did. Not to say that I thought everything else I'd been cast in, I had been tokenized.
Yeah.
I don't think that. But, I think, like, when it is a one-woman show, you kind of think, oh, God, like, it's just me. Why have they picked me? I think, and I would have let my insecurities go, oh, it's because of X, Y, Z reasons. But I just think it's the first time that I... And it's because the team is so lovely, right?
Yeah.
And they have instilled me with so much confidence.
Because they believe in you.
Yeah.
And do you believe in you now that you are? That was an amazing thing.
I believe that they believe in me. And I believe I can do a good job. I do. I believe those two things.
But you don't believe...
I don't know what I don't believe in this situation.
I'm trying to basically get it out that you are successful and that you are like, yes, this is great.
No. I don't think so. But I do believe that they believe in me and I do believe I can do a good job. And that's like leaps and bounds.
Yes, exactly. I was just going to say, I think it's a process. So already the fact that you're not trying to find a rational reason of like, but it was luck. And, you know, they've tokenized me. And, you know, I was at the right place at the right time. And like, I randomly went to that audition before anyone else. And, you know, they didn't have time because there was a fire and no one else could audition for it. So obviously I had to get
Literally every single thing, I make up like a million one excuses.
Yeah, I know.
And I think in a way, like I say to myself, oh, it's keeping me humble.
Yes.
But it's like, but you shouldn't be putting yourself down. But yes. I literally make excuses for everything. I'm like, I only got this because of X, Y, Z. Yeah, literally.
I think, have you tried affirmations before?
I don't know how to do it truthfully.
I'll show you.
Sometimes it feels like I'm faking it.
Because you're saying I am. I am affirmations are not ones that I think you can do if you're in a state where you've never done them before. You can say things like, I attract, I desire, I create. And those are very different to saying, like, I'm amazing, right? Because you're like, well, I don't feel amazing. But if it's, you know, I attract new opportunities into my life, or I attract amazing opportunities, an amazing opportunity could be something that doesn't have to be related to your career. An amazing opportunity could be the fact that it wasn't raining and you had an opportunity to go for a run in the park, right? And I think that's what I've started to change as well, is really choosing affirmations that don't have to be about momentous, massive things that go on. Because the truth is that they don't happen every day. So, like, picking things that are, like, appreciating the small wins.
Well, this is the gratitude thing, right? Like, I really do practice, I try to practice gratitude. And it's like, if you have an amazing cup of coffee or you really enjoyed your lunch, or you had an amazing conversation with a friend, or you laughed.
Yeah.
Like, that's, like, oh my God, there's definitely things to be grateful for. I make a vision board at the beginning of every year.
Okay.
Other things I want to achieve, like, by categories.
Amazing. So when you were younger, did you ever, like, dream of being an actor?
Yeah.
So have you ever done any, like, manifesting? No.
Not really.
But that's interesting, because you've already dreamt. Did you do visualization when you were younger? Would you, like...
I would, like, imagine myself on stage because, like, I enjoyed it.
Right. But that's visualization, no?
Mm.
Because I think all these words are very fancy right now. We're, like, manifesting Law of Attraction, The Secret, like, all of these crazy things. But when you were younger, if you imagine yourself on stage and you imagine yourself acting, that's essentially visualization. Manifesting is just really thinking about what you want, and that's similar to visualization, right? But it's then the process of how you get it. So, like, you said you create a vision board, right? So how do you do that?
I, like, find pictures online, or I'll draw doodles relating to something that I want to achieve or attract in the year.
And does any of that come true?
No. Some. Very few things.
Yeah. So a few things. And then do you do it as, like, a 1 year or a 5 year or a 10 year?
I've done 10 year ones.
Okay.
And I've done, like, year on year ones.
I love it. So, like, I've done a 10 year one and only, like, a few things have come true. No,
But I've done the year on year one as well.
Okay.
I think maybe I'm being too ambitious. Like, unrealistic, do you think?
Well, you're not meant to be realistic. So very, very weirdly, when I first did a vision board, I just put down all the things. I was just like, what do I want? And I basically went on Google, and then I put the pictures as my wallpaper on my phone. And I put, like, a studio like this, and I put a speaking event. And very weirdly, I put McKinsey & Co. I don't know why. I was never clever enough to get a job at McKinsey & Co., but I was also a consultant. I don't know why I put that on there. So weird. And then I put a few brands on there. And then the other day, when I was doing my workshop, I showed everyone my vision board, and I was like, still some of these things haven't come true, but, like, 80% of it came true. And the reason I put it as my phone background is I just, like, glance at it here and there, because I'm very much around goal setting. That's, like, I do workshops on it as well. I'm very rigid with my goals. So I'll be like, this is my vision board of what I want to achieve. Okay, so now how am I going to get it? And then what am I going to do every single month? And what am I going to do every single day? So I think the problem now with the idea of manifesting and vision boards and all of this stuff is, like, if you dream it and you wish it, it will come true. And unfortunately, that's not the case.
No, you have to work hard.
You have to work so hard. And so goal setting is very much aligned to manifesting. But I think the way to do it is to, like, really do it as a dream big exercise and, like, have no doubt in your mind. And then you find a path. And you focus on one thing at a time. Because I do believe if someone came to you and was like, okay, this is my goal, is it possible? You'd be able to give them an answer of, like, okay, this is what you should do. If someone came to you and was like, I want to get a massive acting gig, how would I do it? You'd be able to provide them some guidance.
A map.
But with our own stuff, we're like, don't know, because I'm not going to get that, and this person's not going to like me, and that's not going to happen. And so doing it in that third person is really important. But I'm going to give you my journal.
Okay.
And so you can kind of go through it. But I'm so excited for your play. Tell me a little summary about it.
So it's not a spoiler, because you find out within 30 seconds of the play.
Okay.
This teenager's life across 4 years of her life, from when her sister dies of anorexia, and how that tragedy, again, we find out in the first 30 seconds.
Okay, I'm like, you're
sure. Yeah, the first 30 seconds of the play. And how that tragedy has, and, like, how growing up with a sister who has anorexia and then the tragedy of her death affects the next 4 years of her life. And it is just, within the play, which is, like, an hour and a half, we go through so many, like, universal teenage experiences. And if anything, I hope a lot of teenagers and parents come to the show just so they feel, so the parents can understand more about what teenagers are going through, and teenagers feel less alone about what they're going through. Because I can imagine, and I remember feeling like such a freak when I was a teenager and not really understanding my emotions and my body, and everything's changing. And this play really, like, kind of takes on the teenage experience head first and honors it. And, like, we always say teenage girls can change the world. And I really believe that I feel like teenagers are so disrespected as well in society, and their preferences and their opinions are not taken seriously. This is an ode to like all the teenagers out there, especially teenage girls.
Oh my God, I love it. It's so true. They are, that's like the prime where you like deciding what you want to do and like what you love and like what you enjoy and really figuring out your personality.
Absolutely.
And yeah, you're right. They are disregarded in society. So I'm so looking forward to it.
Thank you.
I'm so grateful for this conversation. Thank you for being
so
vulnerable
much.
And
of course.
So open. And I think it's really going to help so many people.
I hope so.
Thank you. And I'm so excited to see your show.
Thank you. Please
Thank
come.
You. Thank you.